Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal and Kyle Mabry at the controls. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon. We have 10 different topics every week. If you'd like to check in on our schedule, go to our web archive and perhaps listen to programs that you might have missed or sign up for the podcast. You can do that all at the website. It's WILL. That's WILL, WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Philip Pan. He is a former correspondent for The Washington Post. And from 2000 until 2007, he was the Beijing bureau chief for The Post. He's authored a book that draws on his reporting experiences in China during that time. The title of his book is Out of Mao's Shadow, the subtitle, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. It's just recently published. It's out now. It's published by Simon & Schuster. So you can look for it in the bookstore or in the library. He'll talk with us this morning. He is talking with us this morning by telephone. He's in San Francisco, and we're pleased that he could spend some time with us. And questions, of course, for him are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois and Indiana, or if you happen to be listening on the internet across the country, you can use the toll-free number, and that is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, again, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Pan, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. What you've done in the book here is made a major focus of individuals who are trying to, say, preserve the memory of events and people that the government of China would just as soon have forgotten. And the two big things that come up again and again would be the Cultural Revolution and also the crackdown on the pro-democracy demonstrators in Tiananmen in 1989. And of all of the various things that you could have written about in China, and there are many, many stories, why did you decide to have this kind of focus for the book?
Well, I spent 7 years there for The Post, and I think the biggest story that I saw and that I tried to cover was this struggle, a quiet struggle for the future of the country. And on one side is the party and its beneficiaries. You know, they're trying to adapt the authoritarian system to capitalism. And the other side is this collection of ordinary people, lawyers, journalists, artists, entrepreneurs, people trying to change the political system to make China more open, more tolerant, more democratic. And part of that struggle is exactly what you've talked about, the struggle to recover the memory of what happened under the party's rule before they launched into the capitalist era. Mm.
Well, this I'm sure that the impression one would get, or what you would imagine, is that it would simply be to challenge the party would just simply be impossible, and that what happens is that people are arrested, they're put in jail, and certainly there are stories about people who have been arrested and put in jail because they have criticized the party. Just to what extent is it actually possible to do that, and how many people are trying to do that, like the people that you talk about in the book?
Well, it's always difficult to estimate in a country as big as China. And you're right, it's very difficult. These people face tough decisions about whether it's worth it to sacrifice their freedom or possibly put their families in danger in order to push for political change. But I think what we've seen is that there's this an assumption in the West, certainly in the United States foreign policy, that capitalism would topple an authoritarian government, that free markets automatically lead to free societies. But I think, you know, in China, it's been clear that nothing is automatic about this process, that it only happens because of these individuals pushing for change, because they make these tough decisions. And, you know, you said it's impossible. I don't think it's impossible. I think it's tough. And if it were impossible, I don't think these people would be doing it at all.
Mm. Well, this, I think it's interesting. You certainly do touch on this idea that that has been argued. Certainly people here in the United States, I would make this argument. That is that in places where they have authoritarian regimes, that is that economic reform leads to democratic reform, or perhaps economic reform leads to the demands for democratic reform.
Mm-hmm.
And here so far, that's not exactly been the case. And you wonder whether that has something to do with people being satisfied with some rising prosperity and not interested in having democratic reform, or whether in fact that it has more to do with the ability of the government to place limits on what exactly people can do in the way of speaking out politically.
I think both of those things are happening. It's clear that, you know, the government has done a great job in some ways managing this economy. They've had record economic growth for many, many years now in a row. The last 25 years have probably been the best economically for China, you know, in its 5,000-year history. And so a lot of people are satisfied, especially people living in the cities who are educated. They're satisfied with one-party rule as long as they continue getting richer. You know, I don't think it's completely unusual. People are concerned about their families and about their own lives, and I think you know, as long as the party can deliver this for them, they're willing to look the other way in terms of the political system. But at the same time, I think you know, it's clear that the party's repressive tactics are quite effective as well. That people are afraid to speak out sometimes. And what's amazing to me is that there's as many people as there are that are fighting for change. They're not directly confronting the party as they did in 1989 in the Tiananmen Square, but every day people are pushing for change in different ways, and I think they're making progress.
Mm. One of the things that I'm interested in having you talk about is this question of who is done with increasing prosperity, and certainly there has been a very dramatic increase in the average prosperity of people. It has not been equally spread out among the population. Certainly there are people who have done well, particularly people who have who are well educated, who have the ability to work in the high tech sector, who live in large cities, have done well. And at the same time, people who live in the rural areas, and perhaps people who work in the more traditional kind of heavy industries, have in a sense been left behind. And I'm interested in having you just talk a little bit about, with this tremendous increase in prosperity, who has gained and who has lagged behind?
Well, the big winners are the party officials themselves. This form of capitalism that they've adopted definitely benefits the people with power. In the transition from socialism to capitalism, you know, new markets emerge, and you need licenses sometimes to get into these markets. And the government officials with access to these licenses stand to gain a great deal, not only in bribes, but often they're direct participants as entrepreneurs themselves. Secondarily, I think people in the cities, especially the educated people in the cities, urban middle class has emerged, and then they're definitely beneficiaries of this of the economic changes. And left behind, you've mentioned the peasants. In some respects, they've been left behind. In other areas, I think they've gained. You know, certainly hundreds of millions of people in the countryside have been lifted out of poverty. But I think because of the burdens of taxation, you know, what you have in the countryside is basically a system of taxation without representation, and these people are being squeezed very hard by the local party officials.
Mm-hmm.
In the cities, you also have this class of workers, factory workers, who were promised, you know, under communism, that they would have lifetime job tenure, that they would have health care and pensions. And in the rush to privatize basically the economy, they've really been left behind. There was a serious labor movement began to emerge in the early 2000s in the northeastern part of China, what we call the Rust Belt. And I document that in the book. Basically, they're using the party's own rhetoric against it. But the party, you know, this is probably what they're most afraid of, is an organized labor movement, and they were able to crush it.
Yeah. But just very quickly, let me introduce again our guest, Philip Pan. He's former correspondent. He is a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post and is the former Beijing bureau chief for the paper. He was there between 2000 and 2007, is a fluent Chinese speaker, and so that gave him the opportunity to do a lot of traveling and talking to people that maybe some other reporters wouldn't be able to do. And he went to some of those places in China that other reporters didn't go, and has documented some of his experiences in this book that we're talking about. The title is Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. It's published by Simon & Schuster. questions, welcome 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Let me do that again. I'm not sure I got that right. It's 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana and toll free 800-222-9455. In China, a place where workers are supposed to be at the center of everything, what is the state of worker activism? And talk about this effort of people, particularly people who work in traditional heavy industry, to organize.
Well, the law is that there's only one legal union in China, and that's the party's union. It's not really a union at all. In any attempt to organize workers is illegal in many ways. Strikes technically under the law are legal, but you're not allowed to organize, so it becomes very difficult. What we saw in the Rust Belt were these workers, often in their 40s and 50s, who had been guaranteed benefits and pensions, who really sacrificed their youth for the party. We see them being laid off by these state enterprises when they're being privatized. And the effort to organize is very difficult. And yet, when anger reaches a certain level, when desperation reaches a certain level, people do it. And the party has developed a very effective techniques to sort of dismantle these efforts. They often identify the worker leaders, and then they try to turn them against each other. They recruit one worker. They try to recruit the worker leaders as spies. And even if these leaders don't take the offers, often involving a lot of cash, even if they don't take the offers, it creates suspicion and mutual mistrust among the leadership of these worker movements. And so more often than not, they failed.
The other, talk a little bit more about the other thing that you just touched on. You were talking about the difficulties that often people faced in the rural areas with very high taxes and local government officials who are corrupt, clearly corrupt. And there is a story in the book that you tell about a particular place where the people actually said, well, we're not going to take this anymore, and stood up and complained about the local party official there, a man who I think actually he ended up losing his job. Not maybe he wasn't fired. He was transferred after the people in one particular village staged this protest about their level of their taxes.
Yeah, the village is Wangying. It's a small village on the eastern seaboard of China. And what happened there happens all around the country. Every day, peasants leave their villages and come to the provincial capital or to the national capital, to Beijing, and try to get attention to the corruption of the local officials. They usually turn to the party because they know the courts are controlled by the party anyway, and the party usually just ignores them. As foreign correspondents in Beijing, we got phone calls every day, emails every day from people desperate for help, and we had to just sort of pick and choose the stories. What was different about what happened in Wangying is that these peasants managed to get the attention of some Chinese journalists, and two of them in particular wrote a best-selling book about the abuse of power in the countryside, and exposed this party official who, and so he did eventually get transferred, but then he sued the two writers of this book, and the case went to court. It was a fascinating case, pitting party officials' power to use the law versus the people's right to sort of express themselves and criticize the government.
I'm sure that in a formal sort of a sense, the government condemns corruption and tries to root it out. And I'm sure that there are instances where people are charged with corruption. They're tried. I think actually even there are some people who have been executed for taking advantage of their public position. But having said all that, how effective do you think the has been the effort of the government to deal with corruption of government on the part of government officials?
Well, the central government is serious about doing something about corruption, or at least to be seen doing something about corruption, because this is the number one issue that angers the public. They know that if they're not seen trying to address it, the public could turn against them at some point and march in the streets. In fact, it was one of the major issues fueling the 1989 demonstrations. But how effective they can be in policing it is an open question. Many of the top leaders themselves have connections or corrupt themselves. And, it's a question of whether an authoritarian system, really. It goes to the root of the issue here about whether this model of government can be as effective in stamping out corruption as a democratic government. You know, without a free press, they're investigating corruption, and without independent courts and police and prosecutors prosecuting this type of thing, it's really unclear whether they can limit it, much less bring it down. Mm.
It is the case that people who are in a there are people who are in a position to use their position to enrich themselves. Either if they're in government, they can do that. Also, it's important to have connections with people in government. And if you have good connections, that's something that you can also take advantage of. And in this particular section of the book, where you tell these other stories, there's also the story of a woman who at the time, I'm not sure if she still is, but apparently at the time was thought to be the richest woman in China, who had, in among other things, made her fortune in speculating in real estate, and did that by taking advantage of her connections with people in power. This was a woman named Chen Lihua.
That's right. She was the richest woman in China. I think she's since been displaced on the list, or maybe she's managed to hide some more of her assets. But, you know, you use the word speculation. You know, it wasn't really speculation. In China, if you can get access to land, you have to get access through the party, essentially, you're in pretty good shape in terms of making a profit. And in terms of buying the land, you don't even need to put out any cash up front. If you get access to it, the banks will give you loans. And so she's a fascinating story because she was just a seamstress, really. And she was able to befriend a party official who was a neighbor, and she parlayed that into other connections with party officials, and eventually she was granted, because of these connections, all sorts of market access. In the end, it was her access to the real estate, to land, that really enriched her and propelled her to the very top of the pyramid in China.
So how does it happen that somebody like this, that in another time and maybe not all that long ago, would have been denounced as the sort of the ultimate embodiment of the evil of capitalism, end up being somebody that not only was able to take advantage of connections and to get rich, but people now, I suppose, would point to people like her and say, well, this is a success story. That is, they say something like, China needs more people like this.
Well, I think it traces itself back to the Cultural Revolution. After the disaster of the Cultural Revolution, millions of people had died in famine or political violence, you know, and after Mao's death, the government was really on the verge of collapse. The Communist Party, at that point, I think, realized that communism was dead as an ideology. And they turned to these sort of market reforms, capitalist reforms, and they basically abandoned all the values that they had fought for, and instead their primary value became survival. Like you said, this woman was actually criticized during the Cultural Revolution. She did actually suffer during the Cultural Revolution. But now the party's number one concern is staying in power. And so they are willing to forge alliances with entrepreneurs. You know, as long as these businessmen and businesswomen agree to support the party, they are willing to let these people get rich. As soon as a businessman or businesswoman steps out of line, and this has happened a few times in the last few years, the party, it makes it clear to people that you cannot succeed financially unless you stand with the party. And so people have been put in jail and have investigations launched against them. So this is the bargain that the party has struck.
One of the places that you travel to and that you write about was a cemetery in Chongqing, which is, you write, it's apparently the only cemetery in the entire country that is dedicated to people who died during the Cultural Revolution, which apparently was worse there than any place else. If you look at the level of destruction, and Chongqing was worse than any place else. And there were a lot of other places where it was very, very bad. A lot of people died, and a lot, there was a great deal of destruction. What now, in how does the government, say in sort of an official way, talk about what it was that happened during this? This was a period, roughly a 7-year period between 1980 and 1990, back in you'd better say, when was the Cultural Revolution?
Sure. It was a basic. Scholars disagree about the exact years, but essentially it's 1966 until Mao's death in 1970.
So about a 10-year period.
Yeah, but the worst years were the first few years. And in Chongqing in particular, It got very bad because this is in the center of China, a city that Mao had built many of his arms factories, munitions factories. And so when the Cultural Revolution broke out and the young groups were pitted against the party, and the party then organized its own groups, they had access to all these weapons there. And it basically was all-out civil war. This really surprised me, because when you go to Chongqing now, there's no trace of it. Except for this one cemetery. The city is one of the fastest growing in China, and construction is going on at a remarkable pace. People there, in general, don't want to remember this past, and so there's no sign of it. And the party is happy for people to forget this because it affects their legitimacy. But yet this cemetery has survived, and I think it speaks to the resilience of people and of their desire to remember and to honor what happened. The cemetery has several times there's been attempts to sort of tear it down, to bulldoze it, both by the party because of what it reminds them of, but also by commercial developers who want to use this piece of real estate and build on it for profit. But the local residents again and again have managed to stop it, and it's a rundown place, but it's still there. And in fact, when I visited, I met a teacher who is sort of haunts the place and has been trying to do research, trying to record the names of everyone who died there, who's buried there, and document how they died. So there's actual historical research going on. This would have been impossible, obviously, 20 years ago. But I think, with the changes going on there, there's room for this now, and more importantly, there's this desire that for people not to forget.
Yeah. Well, while this was something that was initiated by Mao, I think officially the people who get the blame are these four individuals known as the Gang of Four. Mm-hmm. One of them was Mao's wife.
That's right.
And although it also seems to be this was the kind of thing that very quickly it got beyond the control of anybody. Now, can you, particularly when it comes to, I'm sure you can say anything you want about the former Madam Mao, but what can you say now about Mao himself? And can you come right out and say something like, well, he might have, in many respects, he was a very important leader and got us where we are today, but he also made mistakes. Can you actually say that?
Sure. People say that quite often there. People say much worse. The question is whether you can have that published in a state newspaper, whether you can have that, whether you can say that on television. So there's, there's room now. The government realizes that it cannot control speech completely anymore. It's given people more space. They depend on Mao, though, and his portrait still hangs on the Gate of Heavenly Peace over Tiananmen Square, and his face is on all the money, and they realize that he still lends them some legitimacy, and so they don't allow a criticism of him really in the state media at all. So all the discussion that we hear about Mao, sort of this reevaluation about Mao that's going on, occurs underground. And underground is getting bigger and bigger in China, especially because of the internet.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Philip Pan. From 2000 until 2007, he was the Beijing bureau chief for the Washington Post, and he's authored the book based on some of his reporting experiences when he was in China, Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. It's published by Simon & Schuster. The book's out now. He's talking with us this morning from San Francisco. Sometime later this year, apparently, you're going to go to, are you going to be the Moscow bureau chief for the paper?
That's right. I'm moving there in August. I'm studying Russian right now. I'm looking forward to looking at same issues there, really, but in a completely different environment.
Well, and in addition, we'll continue here to talk about China for another 25 minutes or so. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Going back to talking a little bit more about Tiananmen and how people talk about that, one of the things that you write about in the book was in 2005, right in the beginning of 2005, a man who had been the head of the party, a man named Zhao Ziyang, died. And that was important because he had been purged for supporting the students at Tiananmen. And so at this point, it was an interesting, I'm sure, interesting study for people who studied contemporary China, because the question was, what would the party do? What would the government do? Would they acknowledge his death at all? And if they were going to, then how would they do that? Because obviously, if you acknowledge the fact that he died, you have to talk about who he was.
That's right.
And the fact that he once was the highest ranking official in the country and lost that position, and essentially became a non-entity because the position he'd taken in the Tiananmen. Let's talk about Zhao Ziyang and about what people did when he died.
Sure. Well, the important thing to remember about Zhao is that he died, but he remained a symbol for many people of what might have happened if the massacre had not occurred. If the government had agreed to negotiate with the students had moderated their demands, and if the country had embarked on a course of gradual political reform. Now, he was the symbol of that, and he was placed under house arrest after 1989. He stayed in house arrest all the way up to his death in 2005. The party was determined that people forget him, and they airbrushed him from photographs. They made sure that his name did not appear in history books or in the state newspapers. And so when he died, the party faced a dilemma. It would have been awkward for them to ignore it completely, but they didn't want people to use his death as an occasion to think about what happened in 1989, to remember what happened and to think about, maybe our country might have been better off if we had taken a different course, if we had followed him. And so they, there was a funeral arranged. The party, didn't say much about his death on the media, of course, but they couldn't deny him a funeral at all. This is, one of the moments I decided to really write this book, when I attended this man's funeral and I saw how many people, thousands of people from across the country, came to his funeral. Ordinary people as well as party officials, but many, many ordinary people who really had nothing to gain by doing this, and only really there's only risks, political risks they were taking by coming to his funeral. And so when I saw this, I thought, wow, there's a lot going on in this country, a lot more going on in this country than what you see on the surface in terms of economic growth. Hmm.
One of the people here that did attend, and you write about in this particular section, is a man named Wang Junxiu, who was a college student at the time in 1989 and took part in those protests. For people like him, who not only were they alive at the time, they were actually there. Mm. They took part of it. How do they think about that now? I mean, how do they think about that and what it means? How do they think about that now? And what are they doing in their lives now, in a sense, to carry on that same spirit?
Sure. I think it's always hard to generalize about a whole generation of people. But many of the people, including this gentleman, Wang, after 1989, they suffered a little bit politically for their participation in the protests. They were forced to write confessions, and many of them, especially the ones who were most active in the movement, they had disciplinary action taken against them so that they couldn't get jobs in the universities, they couldn't get jobs in the state enterprises or in the government, and so they were adrift for many years. Wang eventually lands in the internet industry, and at the time of Zhao's death, he was quite prosperous. He's definitely secure in the middle class, but he always had a pang of guilt, I think, about moving on, basically, from 1989. He and many of his classmates, I think, they never forgot what happened in 1989. And, after all, some of their compatriots were killed. Many of their compatriots were killed. And so, they felt a little bit guilty about just moving on, making money. So when 2005 came around and Zhao died, many of them came to this funeral. Some of them were blocked from going. And I think with Wang and with others, we have a generation of people who still have these ideals, but not sure how to act on them. I write in another chapter of Out of Mao's Shadow about a newspaper editor who participated in the 1989 movement. And he decided that the way to act on his ideals was try to publish the best newspaper he could, to use this newspaper to keep the party accountable. And you have, in many, many different subtle ways, people from that generation still pushing for change. They realize that directly confronting the government isn't effective. They realize in a very tragic way. But now they're pushing for change in different ways.
Hmm. Back in May, there was, I'm sure people will recall because it got tremendous kind of coverage, there was a devastating earthquake. It was on May 12th in the province of Sichuan, and a lot of people died. Mm. There was tremendous destruction, and it was certainly that got coverage around the world. And one of the things that struck me as being very interesting was that at least right afterwards, there was a great outpouring of public anger, particularly about the level of destruction of school buildings and people who had lost their children, who were just devastated and were very, very angry because apparently they weren't built very well, or maybe weren't built as well as some other buildings, and there was greater kind of destruction of that particular kind of building than a lot of others. And there was a real outpouring, a very public display of anger, people saying to the government, look, you're responsible for this. And it seemed that the government let that go on for a little bit, and then pretty soon the government was saying, okay, that's enough. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in having you talk about that, how people respond, how the government responded to that, how people responded to that, and this apparently seemingly small window of protest, openly criticizing the government that people were making, you know, what that meant, how that happened, and where that is now.
Well, you know, that is almost a textbook a case of how the party and the media have been at odds in China for a little bit now. When the earthquake occurred, the party's first instinct was its old instinct, which was to suppress the news. They ordered all reporters not to go, and they ordered the media not to report on the earthquake. But the journalists, you know, they have their own ideas, and they defied the censors, basically, and they all headed out to Sichuan, and they all began reporting, and you know, their outlets all published their stories, partly because it was became a market-driven competition, but also because I think there are a lot of people in these institutions who really do believe in freedom of expression, and they saw the magnitude of what happened there. This coverage helped the party in many ways. It made the party's response better. It made the party look better before the public. And I think this is a pattern that we see more and more, that you know, the party's first instinct is to do something stupid, and it isn't able to pull it off, and in the end, it still comes out looking better. And the reason, I think, is because the more democratic, the more open the party is, the more effective it's going to be governing. And even if it doesn't want to be democratic, when people push for these things, they sometimes fall back, and they come out stronger because they're actually governing better. And the case you're talking about is the issue of these schools. In many of these places, many of the buildings survived besides the school buildings, and the suspicion is that local officials were taking bribes in order to allow for shoddy construction. And obviously there's public anger about this now. Some of this was reported in the press, but in recent weeks we've seen a new clampdown by the party against the press. The press can only withstand the censors for so long, and so much of this has been suppressed. But whether it goes away or not is another issue. And I think we've seen that these parents, you know, they've already lost their children. Their anger is deep, and some of them have threatened to continue protesting to bring their case to Beijing, even during the Olympics. Mm.
Just on the recent program here, we have on our station a program called On the Media. They were spending some time in China and spent some time talking with, and at a particular point in the program, they were talking with some young people who were translators and talking about their perceptions about what they thought were Western perceptions of China. That is, you know, how people in Europe or the United States thought about China. One thing that came out of that was kind of interesting, someone in the course of this conversation said something like, comparing China and the United States, they said something like, well, you know, your country is much older. Our country is so young. And anybody hearing that would think, no, wait a minute, what?
Right.
Are you talking about here? China has a history that goes back a couple of thousand years. It was one of the most advanced civilizations in the world at one time, and how how could you say something like, well, our country is so young? Well, of course, their point of reference is the beginnings of the People's Republic. So
right.
If you think about it that way, yeah, it's only about 50 years old. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in how it is that people think about China, how people in China, particularly young people in China, think about, you know, where their country is now, where it stands on the world stage, and do they in fact relate, or how do they relate to all of that massive amount of history that came before the revolution?
Well, you know, I wasn't completely surprised by that answer. I think the party has done a very good job of tying national identity into their political identity. In other words, you know, if you're for China, you must be for the Communist Party, and so they, you know, to some degree, they are proud of what happened before the party's arrival. You know, it is a rich 5,000-year history, but they've been taught to be most proud of what's happened since 1949. And so, when you have Westerners and Western governments criticizing the Communist government, you know, a lot of these people take it personally. You know, they see it as criticism of China and criticism of the Chinese people. And so it's a very, very puts, you know, outsiders in a very difficult position. You want to stand up for justice and for democratic change, but you don't want to be counterproductive by turning the people against these values either.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly it seems to be, even if we have people whose main point of reference, who in a sense think that history, the history of China started with the revolution, they do understand that in fact it didn't just start with the revolution. And
right.
I also, you get the impression that people, particularly young people, feel that China, given everything that it is today, its great economic power, the power of it, of this great resource that it has, its people, and the accumulated history, you get the impression that maybe there are people who think that China doesn't get the respect that it deserves, that it should, by virtue of all of that, should occupy an important part on the world stage. And sometimes I get the impression that some young Chinese people, particularly well-educated young Chinese people, think that China is not given the kind of respect that it should.
Yes, that's true. And this sort of grievance against the rest of the world is something that's fostered by the party. And they use that to make sure these educated young Chinese are on its side. But it's a double-edged sword in politics there. And I think, you know, many of these young Chinese people, especially, as you say, educated young Chinese people in the cities, some of them, maybe many of them, maybe most of them, realize that the reason China doesn't get the respect they think it deserves is because of their government, because of the political system they have. They don't often talk about it necessarily in public. The most vocal people, certainly, that you hear don't talk about it. But in my, you know, time there, I met many young people who understood this, that, you know, until there's political change, there's political reform, China will never be completely accepted as a member of the world community.
Just again to very quickly introduce our guest, Philip Pan. He was the Washington Post Beijing bureau chief from 2000 till 2007, reported from there for the paper. We'll be going on to his new assignment. He's going to be the Moscow bureau chief. We'll be going there this year. He's written a book about his experiences reporting from China, Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China, published by Simon & Schuster, in the bookstore now. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. This year in August, the Summer Olympics for 2008 are taking place in Beijing, and we've known that was going to be for quite a few years now. We know that was going to be the case. For China, just exactly what does this mean, being able to host the Games?
Well, for the government, it's a tremendous opportunity, both to showcase itself around the world, but also, I think more importantly for them, to get a boost of legitimacy domestically. You know, if they can manage to host the Games and host them in a way that is respectable, I think they get a big bump in the popularity ratings, if there were popularity ratings, domestically. And so for the government, they see this as a political tool to boost their standing with the public. for all sorts of other people in China, the Olympics mean different things. I think a lot of people see this as a proud moment for their nation. Others see this as a waste of money, just as you would in any other country, I think. And others see this as an opportunity to air their grievances. And it'll be an interesting situation, I think, this summer, as the security services tighten up and see how things unfold. Already, in the last several months, we've seen several lawyers and other activists get arrested or disciplined in other different ways. One man that I wrote about, a few of the people I wrote about are still in prison, and I think there will be more attention to those cases too as we get closer to the Olympics.
Yeah. Well, this certainly the people who are interested in making a political statement would have to know that this would be one of their best opportunities ever, at least in the sense that now international attention is going to be focused on China and on the games. There are going to be a lot of media and reporters there from all over the world, and I would think that it would make it a challenge. The government would certainly face a great challenge in trying to keep the lid on all of this, on anybody who might want to say something that the government was not real happy with.
Yeah, and the government's aware of this, and they've really mobilized a great deal, both in the media in terms of controlling what's available for people to read, as well as just the basic security apparatus work of keeping so-called troublemakers in check. It's going to be a challenge for the party. But I also think that we shouldn't overstate this. That the majority of people that I've, my sense is that the majority of people in China are quite proud of this moment, and they wouldn't want to necessarily use this to air their own grievances. So there's going to be some restraint, I think, on the public's part.
Well, would that mean that people would be harsher in their judgment of dissidents, people who would want to make a political statement at this time, because they would actually be concerned that it would put their country in a bad light?
I think so. I think, and certainly, the party will try to portray anyone who's makes a splash or tries to protest during these events as traitors, and I think they'll find an audience for that message. On the other hand, if the government overreacts and it comes across looking terribly on the international stage, I do think that some of the public may turn on the government. So it's going to be a delicate dance, and certainly a fascinating time to watch politics in China.
Yeah, for someone like you or any Western reporter from outside China, would certainly, I'm sure, face significant challenges in trying to do your work, because there are many stories that you would want to report that perhaps the government would just assume that you're not, or places that you would want to go that the government just assume that you're not. The same kind of challenge would be faced by Chinese journalists who were trying to do the same thing. What is the state of the media in China? And here, I guess I'm thinking really about what there is in terms of an independent media, at least I think independent of government censorship, or trying to be independent of government censorship.
Well, basically, it doesn't exist. The media in China, well, all the newspapers, magazines, television stations, and radio stations are owned by the government, and they're all under party control. The only independent media in China is the Internet, some of these websites. And the government tries to regulate the websites, but they haven't said that we need to own them yet. So there is some room there. As far as, foreign correspondents, we don't have that. There's not that much risk to us when we try to cover some of these stories. But the real risk that we face is that the people we interview are arrested and imprisoned. There's one man that I interviewed in my last few years there. He was a rural lawyer. He happened to be blind, which I think made it even more difficult for him to achieve what he had. But he took on all sorts of cases against local officials, and his last was a class action lawsuit that he tried to file against abuses of the one-child policy. Women in his village were being forced to have abortions in their eighth or ninth month of pregnancy, and other people were being forced to be sterilized if they had more than two children. And so he tried to file a class action lawsuit against the local authorities. He eventually found me in Beijing, and I had a long discussion with him about whether he really wanted me to write a story about him, because the risk to him would be great, and he could potentially go to prison for it. And he decided that that the risk was worth it, and that the story needed to get out, and he hoped that the abuses would stop. And so I wrote the story about him about a couple years later. Actually, maybe less than a year later, he came back, and I actually saw him getting arrested and being bundled into a car and taken away. And he's still in prison right now. And I think there'll be, you know, it'll be interesting to see in the run-up to the Olympics whether his case, as well as others, get more attention and what the government's going to do about that.
So that probably didn't happen just because you wrote the story, but did the fact that you did write the story have something to do with it?
I think yes. His lawsuit itself had already angered the local government. My writing about it led to other Western media writing about it. And then I do know for a fact that the local officials were using our coverage as evidence against them, saying that he was, you know, this shows that he's aligned with foreign forces that are trying to undermine the government, that he's a traitor, essentially. There were other more enlightened elements within the party, especially in the family planning organizations that were trying to stand up for him. But I think our coverage and this sort of charge that he was a traitor made it very difficult for people to really defend him. And even though he was blind and he was quite a sympathetic figure, they decided to arrest him.
We have a caller here and a couple of minutes left, so let's talk with them. This is someone who is in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. It's good to hear this this talk. I actually lived in China from 2000 to 2002, teaching English in Shenyang. And you're interesting talking about the family planning. I had a baby while I was there, and I had three other friends that had babies too, and they kept asking me questions. Well, don't you have to go and register your pregnancy with the with your government? And they kept asking me all these questions, and I said, no, I don't have to do anything. And so the family planning thing was very interesting because I didn't actually know what they did. My one very good friend had to go in for classes and register the pregnancy and the whole deal so that, they knew all the rules about the one-child policy.
Well, yes, not only are there all these regulations about childbirth, but actually in many villages still, the family planning officials are responsible for checking to see if women are pregnant. And so they actually keep track on a public chalkboard, people's menstrual strike cycles, actually.
People sometimes
overlook the one-child policy in terms of the rights abuses in China because they think, the population is a serious issue there, and they think this may be a justified way to go about it. But, recent research has showed that the government could have made the same gains in population control without the one-child policy, and that these abuses, were completely unnecessary in many ways.
Well, the other interesting thing is the time that we live there is that we live there during the time with the spy plane crash. We also lived there during 9/11, and it was interesting to see the media coverage, especially now with the spy plane crash. It was such a big deal while we were there in 2001, and now you never hear anything about it at all. Nothing about the anniversary, because didn't they make the fighter pilot, they gave him some kind of status or something, but, you don't hear anything about it now.
Well, this is an example of the government's efforts to sort of manipulate nationalism. They want to turn on the sort of nationalist spigot when it suits their purposes. And now, but they don't want it to get out of hand. They don't want people to be mad at the government for not standing up to the Americans, for example. And so, at the time they wanted to take advantage of this, but I think now their priority is domestic stability and economic growth, and for that to occur, they realize it involves good trade relations with the United States, so they don't want to push it too far.
Yeah, well, we knew that the classrooms, they have the classroom monitors, and one of the classroom monitors was actually a very good friend of ours, and we knew that they were trying to keep control of what was going on so that there wouldn't be any problems like there had been when there was the NATO attack or the accidental NATO attack of the embassy before. And so the monitor made an announcement that, you guys are supposed to be nice to Barbara and David, it was my husband and I, be nice to them. We're not supposed to blame them for anything. Mm-hmm. And there was this, obviously they had a meeting about how they were going to treat the Americans that were on their campus.
Well, this goes to another question, I think, which is if this government democratizes, it may not be a pro-American government. There's a lot of sentiment in the public that, you know, built up by the party in many ways against foreigners. We assume that if there's political reform that, you know, we have better relations with China, but I don't think that's certain.
We have about a minute. Just to sum up, where do you think that the country is going to be in, say, 10 or 20 years?
Oh, I think that's the big question. I don't think there's another major world nation, world power, major country in the world that the future is so uncertain. And in terms of how China presents itself on the international stage, I think it really depends on the outcome of this struggle that we're seeing between the forces that want to push for a more open and democratic and tolerant China and those who want to keep the status quo and just manipulate capitalism to keep the one-party system going.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. Mr. Pan, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest, Philip Pan, was the Washington Post bureau chief in Beijing between 2000 and 2007. His book is Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and he'll be going on a little bit later this year to become the Moscow bureau chief for the Washington Post. So you'll be able to read his dispatches from Moscow in the paper.